College basketball can be addictive for fans. According to Dr. Drew Pinsky, addiction of all sorts is the problem of our time. He's built a TV empire around shows such as VH1's Celebrity Rehab and Sober House. He's starting a new series tonight on CNN Headline News. Also tonight, A&E debuts Relapse, a spinoff from one of its popular addiction series. TV critic Eric Deggans thinks the addicts on screen aren't the only ones out there.
My name is Eric, and I'm addicted to the show Intervention.
I'm an addict by definition.
I'm consumed by a drug.
I meet the criteria.
I know how he feels. I've been watching A&E's series on addicts pushed into treatment for several seasons, and I'm still drawn in by its tales of collapse and redemption.
If I had $20 in my name, my last $20, and I had an option to buy dope or have a meal, I have to get the dope.
No wonder Intervention has spawned a cottage industry of addiction-related TV shows. There's A&E's Hoarders, TLC's Hoarding Buried Alive in My Strange Addiction, and tonight's new entry called Relapse.
Sober coaching, the bottom line is to help a client learn to live drug-free. The sober coach is supposed to help you find ways to live without a sober coach. I mean, my job is to put myself out of business one client at a time.
I fear these series feed our appetite for watching others fail. We may learn a little about the devilish details of a hoarding disorder, but we're also drawn in by the drama of a breakdown. Watch the Relapse episode with firefighter and alcoholic David punching fist-sized craters in the walls of his house.
I'm not me when I'm drinking. That is not Dave. That is rum. That is beer. That is wine.
Full of sorrow and fear, he batters the brick and plaster of his modest home, and the holes are evidence of his bottomless frustration.
It's like an exorcism. You have to wait until that is out of my system to see me again.
When you watch a display like that, it's easy to feel a little superior. Bad as your life is, at least you're not him. And if there's a living example of this tension between entertainment and exploitation, it's celebrity addiction specialist Dr. Drew Pinsky. Through shows like Celebrity Rehab and Sober House, Pinsky's added another layer to the addiction TV formula, fame.
By the way, we are speculating. I don't know Brittany. She has chronic psychiatric disorders.
Tonight, he brings those ideas to the channel once known as CNN Headline News.
We are just thrilled to welcome Dr. Drew into the HLN family. Make sure you catch.
He'll cover lots of topics, but Pinsky won't shy away from talk about Charlie Sheen or Lindsay Lohan. His message? Tune in for the drama, but stay to learn something. Still, for this addiction TV addict, the glare of Dr. Drew's celebrity spectacles obscures any larger lessons. At least, when I'm focused on the regular folks in A&E's addiction series, there's a hope that what I'm learning outweighs the exploitation.
Eric Deggans is TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
This Sunday on PBS, the Masterpiece Classic Anthology series begins presenting new installments of Upstairs, Downstairs for the first time in 34 years. Our TV critic David Biancooley has a review.
To me, the only depressing thing about the return of Upstairs, Downstairs, which ran on what was then called Masterpiece Theater from 1974 to 1977, is that I reviewed it the first time around. How time flies when you watch too much TV. But I loved it then, and in this new, surprisingly fresh yet faithful sequel, I love it now. Upstairs, Downstairs was one of the first miniseries hits, years before Roots. It told of life at 165 Eaton Place, a posh residence in London, with a dual focus on the privileged folks who lived there and the servant staff that waited on them, hence the title. And both the upstairs and the downstairs were full of intrigue, comedy, drama, and very lively and unpredictable characters. One of them was Rose, the maid played by actress Jean Marsh, one of the co-creators of the series. Back in 1974, in the opening scene of the very first episode, we met Rose greeting a new job applicant for the household staff. At the downstairs servant's entrance, of course.
Mrs. Pratt's agency sent me.
Well?
I've come about the position. Elf parlour maid, was it?
And a house parlour maid. I am the house parlourmaid. Well, come in. Now tell Mr. Hudson you're here.
Who's Mr. Hudson?
The butler. Oh, the bloke all in black at the front door.
The first Upstairs-Downstairs miniseries covered the years from 1903 to 1909. Four additional miniseries followed, covering World War I and the Roaring Twenties. All five seasons, by the way, have just been released in a wonderful new DVD box set by Acorn Media. And now, 34 years after Upstairs-Downstairs left PBS, it's back. And so is Jean Marsh as Rose. But she's the only returning character from the original series. Unless you count the house, which you should. It's one of the smart moves in this new sequel, using Rose and the old address to introduce us to a whole new world of characters and plots. But not too new. In the world of Upstairs Downstairs, we rejoin the story in 1936, only 6 years after the old series ended. Rose, when we first see her in this new version, looks old and weary. But the second a visitor to the employment agency she runs mentions a familiar old address, Rose brightens considerably. The visitor is Keeley Hawes, playing Lady Agnes, whose husband has just purchased a long-dormant property in the neighborhood.
We require a butler with sommelier experience, and a housekeeper, of course, to oil the wheels behind the scenes. Then a parlourmaid and a chauffeur come manservant, and absolutely the best cook you can find me.
Very well, m'lady.
What a splendid teapot.
It was a gift, my lady, from my late employer, Lord Bellamy of Haversham. Do you have a budget in mind for staff?
This is what my husband suggests.
I see. Well, if you don't mind my saying so, with a professed cook, you'll be wanting a kitchen maid as well, and a pantry boy who can double as a footman. You'll need to account for a wage for them.
Yes, but they'd be very juvenile and grateful for the experience, surely. The house is in Eaton Place, number 165. So not far to walk when you come to carry out the interviews.
I usually do that here, m'lady.
I'll be supervising builders. Meeting at the house will be the most convenient thing. May I assume this is all within your powers?
Yes.
Splendid.
The time frame for the new Upstairs Downstairs allows it to play against some major world events, such as the rise of fascism and the abdication of the king. If you want, you can think of this not only as a sequel to Upstairs Downstairs, but as a prequel to the king's speech. But also, there are events that take place and precedence from inside the walls of 165 Eaton Place. A flirtation between a pampered upstairs society girl and a headstrong downstairs chauffeur. An unexpected live-in mother, played delightfully by Eileen Atkins, the actress who, along with Jean Marsh, concocted the original miniseries in the first place. Other standout stars in this new volume include Keeley Hawes as Lady Agnes, who hires Rose, and Claire Fay as Agnes's spoiled sister. There's even a meaty role for Art Malik, whom I remember as a scene stealer from another landmark PBS miniseries import, The Jewel in the Crown. But hey, I've been watching these things a long, long time. This new Upstairs Downstairs, though, does indeed seem new. It's not weighed down with nostalgia or sentiment. There's some real danger dramatized here, and lots of shocks and twists. And just when you think you know these characters, they surprise or disappoint you. In both the master suites and the serving quarters, there are characters to love and characters to hate. But all of them are characters you want to spend even more time with. My only criticism of this Upstairs Downstairs sequel is that they've returned with only 3 new episodes. Clearly, the partners in this new enterprise, Britain's BBC and WGBH's Masterpiece, should make more. Many, many more. They have proven that Thomas Wolfe was wrong. You can go home again. And if your home address is 165 Eaton Place, you should.
David Biancooley is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com, and teaches TV and film at Rowan University in New Jersey.
The latest Spanish-language soap opera sensation, La Reina del Sur, is hitting the airwaves on Telemundo. In its debut week last month, it ranked first in the 10 o'clock time slot across all U.S. broadcast networks. It's the first Spanish soap to feature a female drug lord, And as Genesis Sanchez reports, it's the latest in a fast-growing genre, telenovelas about Mexico's explosive drug war.
I'm usually not a big fan of sitting down and watching TV when I get home, but the 10 o'clock hour became my sacred TV time. Once my friends told me about Muñecas de la Mafia, or Mafia Dolls. It's about five young women getting involved with the drug dealers known as narcos in Colombia and Mexico. That's a drug lord grabbing one of his main girls by the hair and accusing her of being a snitch. These soap operas aren't too far from the reality of the drug war in Mexico these days, with all the same dramatic ingredients: executions, lavish lifestyles, and international fame. They're part of what I call narcocultura. Radio DJ Sergio Garcia just moved to the U.S. from Tijuana about a year ago and says many young people there idolize the drug dealers.
Ah, yo quiero ser narco. O está de moda.
It's almost as if saying, I want to be a narco is in style, as is having a brand new car, having rhinestones on your clothes, going to nightclubs, having a lot of women, having a lot of money, and just being able to spend however much you want. It's mainly just about being able to feel that power.
Narcocultura broke into pop culture about 5 years ago with a type of music called narcocorridos, Mexican drug ballads. Mafia nueva, sinaloense, pura plebada de arranque. The lyrics are all about who the drug lords will kill next, their guns made out of gold and decorated with diamonds, and how many women they have. Narcocorrido fans are usually men trying to get their macho fix. The narconovelas on TV, on the other hand, target women.
No anda con un man cualquiera, no. Tiene que ser el man más embilletado con las que pintas.
Muñecas de la Mafia is nothing like the typical soap operas. Stories of a poor girl in love with a rich guy whose evil grandma hates on their romance. In Mafia Dolls, the struggles are all about surviving in the drug game. The show debuted on the Univision Network last year around the same time that big-name narco families were getting busted in Mexico. Producer Dago Garcia is the vice president of production at Caracol TV in Colombia, where most of the narco novelas are produced. Garcia says a decade ago, Colombian producers would have been too scared to portray narcos.
The narco theme had been suppressed for different reasons, mainly because it was a topic that couldn't be discussed without having your life at risk.
Now that Colombia's government claims to have won the battle with drug dealers, Colombian producers are safe to make shows about drug culture. And these novelas are being distributed all over Latin America and the U.S., influencing how Latinos in other countries view the drug war. My friend Carmen Ramirez is surprised to find herself sympathizing with the narcos on Muñecas de la Mafia.
For example, you'll see me commenting on the novela and I'll just be like, oh, I feel bad for him because his daughter gets kidnapped. But then again, I don't feel bad when they shoot an innocent person.
Lupe Gallegos-Diaz, who works with Chicano students at UC Berkeley, thinks that narconovelas glamorize the drug world.
Most of the time, it's about a sexual objectification of women and what I considered not very healthy, sometimes, messages for our young women, particularly short skirts, you know, low cleavage, high heels.
There is more complexity being written into future narco soaps. Novela producer Dago Garcia says he's going to add another layer to the stories.
The next dimension of what we're going to talk about in this subject is the dimension of the victims. Because up until now, all these productions have been taking a look into the reality of narcos and their relationships.
It seems like everyone I talk to about narcocultura is also passionately following news of the drug war in Mexico. But with these new narconovelas, it's easy to lose sight of the line between the real-life war and the entertainment inspired by it. For NPR News, I'm Genesis Sanchez.
Genesis Sanchez is a reporter for Turnstile, that's an online news service from Youth Radio.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's time again for our regular home video feature where Bob Mondello offers suggestions for your DVD queue. Today, he's quite high on Cole Porter's Anything Goes, not the movie or the stage show, but a TV curiosity from 1954 with quite a cast performing live.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Ethel Merman only got to sing 8 bars of this song in the film version, so when TV beckoned 18 years later, she leapt. her co-stars Frank Sinatra in a career lull, and her old buddy Burt Lahr of Cowardly Lion fame. She and Lahr had shared a showstopper in another Cole Porter musical, so they just slipped it in.
If you're ever in a jam, here I am.
Merman had less rapport with Sinatra. She and young Blue Eyes share what has to be the least passionate on-screen kiss ever, but this was live TV, so the show goes on even when Merman has to freeze a smile for 5 full seconds, or when Sinatra blows a lyric that wrecks a rhyme.
You're the top. You're some candied ribbon.
He meant ribboned candy.
You're the top. You're Napoleon Brandy.
See? Later, Lahr refers to Merman not as Lady Oakley, but as Annie Oakley, a part she played in Annie Get Your Gun, and then the show wraps up a full 3 minutes early, so they kind of have to punt.
I have an idea. Rather than do the usual goodnight speech that you were supposed to do here, seeing as how we have a little time, why don't you do Anything Goes or something again for us?
Huh? All right. You hear anything with me,
though? No, if I know the words.
Only Sinatra does not know the words, so he ducks off camera. But in mid-song, she motions him back, and he tries, he really tries, then realizes he's useless, and then, for a few seconds, Ethel Merman has the most expensive backup singer ever.
So even out in high society, can't forget variety, goodness knows.
It was live television. Anything went. I'm Bob Mondello.